Welcome to Admit One, a brand new podcast series where I talk to celebrity friends and guests from across the arts about their favourite movie memories. I'm Antonia O'Brien, and here's a snippet of what's coming up in the series.
Because I thought, oh my God, like me, her and Cameron Diaz are going to be snapped by the paparazzi on the beach.
You know, I'm just utterly in love with Molly Ringwald to this day. I can't even begin to deny it.
That was my first experience of a woman kicking ass in a intellectual, powerful way.
So without Enter the Dragon, I would never have got into songwriting.
Hello and welcome to Admit One, the film podcast for film lovers with me, Antonia O'Brien. I am especially excited for this episode because today we have the film critic extraordinaire, Mr. James King in the studio. James, thank you so much for coming in and talking to me today.
I never feel extraordinaire is used enough in this world, is it?
Never.
It's such a great word. You know, and people just don't use it enough. We say whatever all the time. Let's get rid of these slang Americanisms and get extraordinaire back into modern vocabulary.
I agree. Let's sub out like with
and
extraordinaire
totally.
And fantastic and absolutely. Now, before you came in today, we set you the challenge of picking your top three favourite films.
Yeah.
Was that difficult for you?
Two of them are relatively easy. Mm. The third one is sort of a floating choice, which can change. But two of them, like I said, two of them are set in stone. It will always be those two.
Long-term commitment to those top two films. Before we get onto those film choices, I'd love to know actually a little bit more about you. I know you as film critic and friend. We've worked together.
We have on Freezing Cold Red Carpets.
Freezing Cold Red Carpets at the BAFTAs. Have you always loved film?
No, is the honest answer. They were a part of my life as a small child in as much as most kids see movies and, you know, watch stuff at home or go to the cinema every now and then. But the absolute obsession kicked off when I was a teenager. When I was 15, it was summer 1990. And
that's very specific. I feel like that's a cinema trip that maybe
It was a specific moment. It was a Friday night. I think my parents were out. So I was on my own watching Vic Reeves' Big Night Out, which used to be on Friday night, which is an amazing show. And after that, there was a film called Play It Again, Sam, which is a Woody Allen movie from the 70s, in which Woody Allen plays a film critic obsessed with Humphrey Bogart. And so I was on my own in the house watching this. Parents were out. And I hadn't really watched, I think I'd maybe watched a Woody Allen film or two before that, but I hadn't really seen them. And I saw Play It Again, Sam, and I just saw this guy's lifestyle of watching films all the time, being obsessed with Humphrey Bogart in this case, and writing about them. And it just was a light bulb moment. I just thought, that's what I want to do.
So that inspired you and you thought, oh my gosh, as if that's actually a job. So what went from...
By the way, incidentally, I should say about Play Against Sam and Woody Allen, he's a nerd, obviously. I mean, he's a nerd before they were called nerds. And I think as a sort of geeky teenager, I latched onto that as well. I thought, okay, so this is what nerds do. They become film critics. You know, they don't become astronauts. They don't become SAS, you know, military men. They become film critics. Okay, I get it.
For a film lover, it is something of a dream job. Does it ever feel like a chore? You know,
yes.
Monday morning, first thing, you've got to see some kind of, you know, bloody, gory horror film. You're like, this is a weird start to the week.
In fact, I say it's another bloody, gory horror film. yes, it is. And I think I've changed over the years. I can't claim to be as passionate as I once was about new films week in, week out, what is new, because you, as you get older, you sort of hold on to your favourites and you want to explore them a bit more.
Those top two.
Yeah. And, you know, I'm writing a book at the moment, which is about older films and films that I've loved for a long time, as opposed to just what's next, what's next, what's next. And that constant hype machine of new films is pretty wearing after a while. I've been doing it for 20 years and that does get pretty exhausting where you go, you know what? I'm just not bothered about Pirates of the Caribbean 5. I just don't care.
Fair enough.
Actually, that's out the same week next summer as Baywatch. Now, Baywatch I am interested in. The Dwayne Johnson Baywatch.
Is, but, you know, we're not hassling the Hoff, right? Is he in it?
I believe he is in it, yeah.
Oh my gosh.
But so
brilliant!
A lot of new films, yes, of course you still get excited by, and at the moment we're recording this, it's awards season, so you get the real cream of the crop.
Yeah, which we will be coming on to.
But sometimes you just go, you know, umpteenth sequel to a very average predecessor in a franchise I don't care about. It is difficult.
Not bothered.
Yeah.
Have you ever walked out of a film?
Yeah.
Which film was that? I'd love to know.
Well, it's not a good thing to do if you're a critic. No. It's not something I'd recommend. I could probably count on one hand how many times it's happened. The first time it happened as a professional was Tomb Raider.
Really?
Which, I mean, I just thought it was terrible. And I thought it was terrible when it had the potential to be good, because Angelina's a really good actor. At that point, it won an Oscar, was the next big thing. And I just couldn't believe that. I mean, physically, I could understand why she was doing that movie, but she's smart and she's good. And it just seemed such a waste for her to be doing something like that. And it wasn't even like a cool, stylish action movie. I don't mind cool, stylish, dumb summer blockbusters, but I don't think it really had that.
And what do you make of Alicia Vikander filling her lace-up boots, shall we say? I can't believe it's coming back. And I think that is such an interesting choice for Vikander, well, who so far has done nothing wrong. I mean, it could be the stylish version that you wish.
Well, but
it was.
Her other half, Michael Fassbender, is doing Assassin's Creed, you know, so they both go for the gaming market.
Yeah.
She's brilliant. I really like Alicia Vikander. The stage she's at now is an even more credible stage than Angelina was when she first did it. So to see her do it is a very strange choice.
She's been very smart with her choices. It's been such an eclectic mix.
Yeah.
But so far, no big, big blockbusters.
No.
Yes, big Oscar wins and big Oscar choices, kind of classic films like The Danish Girl.
Yeah, but and nothing, retro movies.
Yeah, but nothing that's so sexy.
And so reliant on her. So there's a lot on her shoulders. She's great. So I can only hope it's good and I don't have to walk out again.
James King, we worked together at the BAFTAs. What are the standout moments on the red carpet for you?
There was a year at the BAFTAs when actually Brad and Angelina turned up. Oh, God bless them. I can't believe they're no more.
2016 strikes again.
What a year.
What a year.
When they turned up and Angelina was in a tuxedo. And in a way, those kind of moments are so removed from me sat watching a Woody Allen film in my parents' house as a teenager. But I still get excited by those moments. I'm interested in that. I'm interested in fashion and the glamour because it's part of it. It's part of the machine, whether you like it or not. And that was that, you know, in my head, I imagine everybody, as we all were, behind the rope, sighing and gasping. I don't know if we did. Maybe we were just cold. But there just seemed to be a feeling in the atmosphere and from the crowds all waiting that when they rocked up, there was just a sort of collective jaw drop where we all went, wow, this is a power couple, a Hollywood A-list couple, and they're here, they're just feet from us.
Now, as a film critic, you've already seen a lot of films that will be contenders for the 2017 Oscars. What are your predictions?
I watched Arrival, which is Amy Adams, Jeremy Renner, and the thought that had gone into it to make sure every moment, every line, every scene was there for a point and worked, that was something that really impressed me. Manchester by the Sea, I think, will do well, which is Casey Affleck. It's sort of a big moment for him, really, where he's always slightly been in the shadow of his older brother, but he's going to be really recognised as a good actor. So that's a pretty good movie. I suspect Michael Keaton will do well this year for the third year in a row, following on from Birdman and then Spotlight. He's got a movie called The Founder coming out, where he plays Raymond Kroc, who was, well, he claimed to be the founder, it's not quite that simple, of McDonald's, the McDonald's chain. And not the greatest film, but it's a very good Michael Keaton performance. And 2 years he's missed out on winning. So you'd think, okay, third time lucky, probably.
So you feel like that could be a standout for a best actor.
Well, it's, you know, a lot of voting, whether it's Oscars or whatever awards, is about the mood and the moment. Does it feel right?
Like DiCaprio.
Yeah, I wouldn't say that was his greatest film or greatest performance, but the moment felt right and the competition just was nowhere near him.
He would have been so robbed.
Exactly.
He would have been so robbed if he missed that again.
And so I think there's that feeling with Michael Keaton that, like I said, with Birdman and Spotlight, two great comeback films for someone who had been out of the loop for a little bit. Maybe this year will be his year. But, you know, there's stuff I haven't seen yet that I think there's a new Scorsese film, for example, that you would be foolish to write off.
Talking about Arrival, do you think Amy Adams is going to have, you know, a full house of awards? Because, you know, you hear her in interview and she's incredibly self-deprecating and doesn't want to get wrapped up in that pre-awards hype, because it must be impossible to handle every critic asking you, you know, do you think you're going to get a best actress for this? In your opinion, after seeing that film, do you think Well, I think it could be a sure thing.
I think she'll be nominated. Of course, she's also got Nocturnal Animals out as well, in which I thought she was great. I'm not sure if either of those performances are traditional Oscar winners. You do have to think a little bit more about transformations and ailments and all the cliches that we're a little bit cynical about, but it's true. and she's not doing any of those things in those movies. She's not doing what DiCaprio did in The Revenant and really suffering
eating
for her
art.
Eating
a bison liver.
Exactly. And that's the only thing I thought was missing from that Arrival, actually. Yeah. There was no bison liver eating.
No bison liver. Vomiting.
I know, yeah.
What was I watching recently? And a bison was in it. Oh, Planet Earth 2.
Right, okay.
And I thought for a long-term vegetarian, maybe even a vegan, DiCaprio, I mean, that was the most authentic starvation, eating the bison liver and then that vomiting. I mean,
so maybe
Oscar-worthy in itself.
Well, exactly. And that people do notice that, you know, and if you're voting, I vote in the BAFTAs, you look at this long list of all the films you've seen and you need something to remember. And if you look at the Revenant and you go, oh my God, well, I remember DiCaprio doing all this weird stuff in that, it's probably more likely to get a tick in its box. So I love Amy Adams. I think she's great. I hope that she does well, but they might not be quite the right things.
Okay, so let's find out what you, James King, have chosen for your top three favourite films. What is your first choice?
My first choice is Grease from 1978, John Travolta, Olivia Newton-John. I'm not even going to entertain telling people what it's about.
What happens in that film?
Feel a bit silly because you only have to switch on E4 or Film 4 or something like that and it will be on. So if you haven't seen it, don't worry. In a week or two's time, it'll be on again.
And also, where the hell have you been?
Exactly. So, yeah, that would be my number one and probably the most influential, I would say. That might just be because it's one of the first films I ever saw.
What is it about Grease that has made it such a coming-of-age film for so many people across so many ages? Why is that, do you think?
Well, it never dates because it was retro when it came out. So if you... Although you could argue that maybe the theme tune, which Barry Gibb wrote, has a sort of element of 70s disco about it.
On the whole, it's
set in 1959, 1960, so it's going for that look. So you can watch that in 1978 when it came out. You can watch it now and it still looks like 1959 and 1960. So it doesn't look old-fashioned in the way that something like Saturday Night Fever might do, which you could laugh at the funny white suit. Mm. Whereas, you know,
as great as he looks in it.
I love Saturday Night Fever, but I think Grease was never trying to be of the moment and trendy, so that's why it doesn't date. But the music is great, the performances are great.
Is there a standout scene for you when you think about Grease?
The standout scene for me is a moment that confused me when I was a child and watched it, because I was very young when I watched it. And essentially, when I first watched it, as little more than a toddler, you just latch onto the music. You latch onto the colours and the dancing and the songs. But there was a moment where Danny meets up with Sandy again after their holiday romance. He doesn't know that they're at the same school. And the others have twigged this and they've set up this meeting at one of the pep rallies for them to meet up and be reunited. And so they bump into each other and they're like, oh my God, Sandy, what are you doing here? Oh, Danny, I can't believe it. And they're so excited. And Danny realises that all of his mates are watching and starts to strut and starts to pose and starts to act
cool.
Exactly. I can't really show that I'm, you know, emotions. I have to be a bit cool. And I didn't get this. I just thought, well, hang on. They started off at the beach snogging to Love Is a Many Splendid Thing. What, you know, this was only a few weeks ago. Why is he now acting like this? You know, I was 4 or 5 years old. I didn't get that. But that really...
The cruel world of romance as a teenager.
And that was one of the first moments that confused me about Grease as a child. And I think that's why it stuck with me so long.
For you, is this a textbook feel-good film?
It is a textbook feel-good film, but I do feel with all... Well, okay, with most teen movies, and teen movies are sort of the genre that are my passion, there is also a bittersweet feeling about them because you know that it's not going to be like that forever. And probably Danny and Sandy would have split up. I mean, we've got to be honest. You know, they are playing teenagers at a high school romance. And of course, it ends with the fairy tale moment of them flying off into the sky. There's actually a very funny Family Guy sketch where it shows what happens afterwards. And they're Danny and Sandy are like in space in the car and they're freezing cold, you know, essentially on their last legs because they're stranded flying into the atmosphere.
Only Family Guy.
Yeah. But what happens next, I think, with teen movies always fascinates me because you know that these are very young people admittedly, they weren't that young in real life when they played them, but they're playing young people. And school has this sort of very romantic effect on you where you're in a bubble. But what happens when you're outside of that bubble? And most films end, you don't know. But that to me is, yes, it's feel good, but it's also bittersweet because I also think, well, it could never last.
You just touched on teen movies. Would you say this is maybe the first teen movie of that sort of genre, yeah, which has now gone on to lend that kind of idea to so many?
Yeah. The 70s were very interesting when, because this came out at the end of the 70s, there was a revival really in people's interest in the classic American teenager, the James Dean, Marlon Brando, leather jacket, you know, Brill Cream teenager. Grease, of course, plays on that. There were other things like American Graffiti and Animal House and things like that. And I guess it's because America in the 70s, I mean, you know, God, you only have to look in your history books to see about Watergate, to see about Vietnam, to see about the terrible things that were going on in America in the 70s. And I think filmmakers of a certain age were going, why not? Let's go back to the 50s.
Yeah, things seem glossy.
Things seemed so much simpler then, when it was just rock and roll and leather jackets and, you know, a doo-wop. You know, let's go back to that. So there was a real movement in the 70s of trying to forget the troubles of the present day and look back to a simpler time.
Talking about teen movies and teen stars,
yeah,
perfect segue.
Yeah.
What is your second film choice?
My second film choice is Ferris Bueller's Day Off, starring Matthew Broderick, written and directed by John Hughes. Again, you've probably seen it. If you haven't, just think of the title. That tells you what it's about.
Ferris Bueller has a day
yeah
out.
Although a sneaky one, because he's not meant to have a day off. It's playing truant. Don't do it, kids. Can't
stay
recommend
at
it.
School.
Yeah,
stay at school.
Kids. Although, let's be honest, Ferris had a great day off. That was a hell of a day off.
I mean, I can only imagine there are several scenes that are probably your fave that really make you laugh. But if
yeah
you had to pick one.
I think the musical scenes, the Germany Day Parade, which happens whilst Ferris and Sloane and Cameron are playing hooky in Chicago. There's this big parade going on. And Ferris takes to the stage and starts belting out Twist and Shout by the Beatles and Dunkershern and mucking about. And we'd already known by this point in the film that Ferris can pretty much do anything. That's the joy of his character, is that he seems so confident and so individual and charismatic. But that's like the real show point where he just gets up on stage and shows off. You know, 80s cinema for me is a lot about those moments, moments of indulgence, moments of excess, where the plot could completely carry on without those moments, but we just wanted to sit back and watch a big song and dance number and some choreography and you know, some flashy direction. And Ferris singing Dunkershern is just an absolute joy.
Talking of direction, it's directed by John Hughes.
Yeah, teen maestro.
The teen maestro, the yeah 80s king.
Yeah.
Pretty in Pink, Breakfast Club, a family favourite of mine, National Lampoon's Vacation, which is why I love your Twitter picture so much. If you had to pick a favourite John Hughes,
yeah,
would that also be your film choice for Admit One?
What, Bueller, you mean? Yeah, it would probably be Bueller, just in terms of the effects it's had on me, I think. I like all of them. I'm actually a big fan of Pretty in Pink, which he wrote and produced. You know, I'm just utterly in love with Molly Ringwald to this day. I can't even begin to deny it. And
that moment when she comes out in the homemade pink dress.
I mean, you know, they said you should never do ginger hair and pink, but she proves everyone wrong.
Molly proved all yeah the style critics wrong.
Tell me about it. I mean, I think Bueller has it all because it is romantic as well. It's very funny. It's so stylish, so cool. And has such a unique outlook and a unique plot. Pretty in Pink is perhaps a little bit more generic, but I'm still a real sucker for it.
How many times do you think you've seen Ferris Bueller's Day Off?
It's a good question. I mean, 30 plus easily. I mean, I honestly don't know.
Like a comfort favourite?
Yeah,
Sunday
it
afternoon,
is
you're
yeah
like, oh, gosh,
there
I
is
need a
the only thing I'd say Ferris about both Grease and Ferris, and this also works with like my favourite albums as well, is that you do get to a point where you've seen them so many times that actually you can kind of go several years without watching them and they still feel really fresh in your mind. And, you know, I might not have seen Ferris for a couple of years now, which seems awful for me to say, but I might not have done. But I just have seen it so many times that it's there. You know, I can play it out in my head if I need to.
And you know which scene's coming next.
Yeah.
You can almost recite the next line.
I did an MA in film studies and I wrote my thesis on Ferris Bueller's Day Off. And it was a little showy because I did it whilst I was working as a part-time thing. And I said to my lecturer, you know, you kind of need to see this if you're going to read my 10,000 word essay on it. He said, I haven't seen it. So I lent him a video, and I'd actually met Matthew Broderick and it had it signed. So I lent him a video and said, to James, all the best, Matthew Broderick.
Nice work. My next question was actually going to be, do you agree with that statement where people say you should never meet your idols? Because I was going to say, have you met Matthew Broderick? What was it like to meet Ferris?
He's lovely. He's quiet. He's not Ferris Bueller. It's a very obvious thing to say, but he's not Ferris Bueller. As a joke, I once said to Sarah Jessica Parker, oh, you're married to Ferris Bueller. And, you know, she was fine about it, but you could sense a little bit of annoyance because she's not married to Ferris Bueller. She's married to Matthew Broderick, who is very different. And he's very sweet and very kind, but he's not that larger than life character.
He never skipped school.
No, he probably didn't.
He did not have a day off.
But I think he's great, Matthew Broderick. I'm a big fan of his, and he's, you know, a great song and dance man and Broadway star, as well as a movie star. But it's not like he turned up and, you know, was wearing a leopard skin waistcoat and, you know.
And his old Converse.
Exactly.
Before we go on to your third film choice, James, I wanted to know, how did you do in that dissertation?
Yeah, all right, I passed.
The signed DVD by the film star didn't help nudge it.
No, I think they probably just thought I was a bit of an idiot to do that. You know, probably marked me down.
Okay, and James King, what is your third film choice for me?
My third film choice, which is the one that it's a bit more loose, but the one I decided on the other day is Donnie Darko. If I'd have known you wanted me to explain the plot, I'd never have chosen Donnie Darko.
It's okay. We won't
When I think about
the film, I still am not sure what happens in that film.
Yeah, I would say this, that to me, it's a superhero movie, albeit a very warped superhero movie, about a teenage boy who dodges death, who cheats death, and is given a second chance, really, a small window of opportunity, a month to clean up his town, to help his community and save his community, and does that through a variety of acts. But it's so many things, Donnie Darko. You know, it's a time travel film. It's a film about teenage depression. It's a film about America in 1988. There's a lot of things going on. It's not easy to quantify. And it has bemused a lot of people. To be honest, for me, the bemusing element of it is the thing that I love. I almost don't want to understand Donnie Darko 100%. I think I'm 90% there, and each time I watch it, I get a bit closer and find something else out.
Would you say that's something you love about those complex films that maybe we don't immediately understand? You love that every time you watch them, you see something different and you understand it in a different way?
Exactly. Sometimes you want an instant hit, but I very rarely go back to those movies. The movies I watch again and again are the ones that baffle me and confuse me a little bit. And speaking of Jake Gyllenhaal, you know, he was in Nocturnal Animals as well. And that's a film that I want to go back to. I've seen it once. I liked it. I didn't love it. There are things I have issues with. There are things I'm confused by with that film. I cannot wait to go back and watch it again to try and unlock some of those problems. Jake Gyllenhaal is, I think, brilliant at choosing those movies. Donnie Darko is a very early role for him. He's also great at doing stuff at nighttime, at Nocturnal Animals, Nightcrawler.
I was just writing Nightcrawler here because I saw that last year, and also just jotted down Moody and Snarling. He does, you know, he does that kind of darker character, and I loved Nightcrawler.
Oh, I think that's his best film.
It finished, and
actually,
I could have actually just sat down and watched it again that second.
I think that's his best performance, Nightcrawler. He's great in Donnie Darko, but Nightcrawler, there's more of a character arc for his character to blossom and to grow. But he's great at nighttime.
He is.
He's great in the shadows. He's good at playing characters who have that troubled side.
There's something about, you know, he has those kind of deep, sad eyes. I think they translate really well to those troubled characters.
I think you have to accept that a lot of our feelings about actors are to do with how they look, and actual acting in terms of delivery is sometimes secondary. Now, if Jake Gyllenhaal just looked like a sort of shop mannequin, then maybe I wouldn't like him as much. He'd probably deliver his lines in exactly the same way, but he just wouldn't have that resonance as an actor.
You said that third film sometimes subs in. Today it's Donnie Darko. I'd love to know what other films have taken that place before.
Well, there's a lot of films from that era, and I was trying to work out what I was doing or why it might be that around the turn of the millennium, I have a lot of films that I loved. I don't know if there's a reason. I mean, I was working at Radio 1 and I was in my 20s, and I can think why I was a toddler and loved Grease, and I can think why as a 11, 12-year-old I loved Ferris Bueller. But maybe part of the answer, certainly with Donnie Darko, is because of the position I was in at that time, I was able to champion them. I was in America, I think it was for the Oscars, and found Donnie Darko on DVD. And it said Drew Barrymore on the cover. I love Drew Barrymore. That's why I got it. It was sold as a horror film. I'm not particularly interested in horror films, but I am interested in Drew Barrymore films. So I picked up this DVD and thought, well, I've never heard of it, but I'll give it a go. And I bought it back, and I remember watching it one Sunday morning, just being utterly blown away by it, because it wasn't anything that I expected. And nobody knew the movie over here. It hadn't come out. So I sort of investigated, was it ever coming out in the UK? And it was. It was a small film company who were releasing it. So in my position then at Radio 1, we sort of set up some preview screenings to get people to see it early, to build up a buzz about it. So I think with Donnie Darko, I love the film, but also I was a little bit involved in getting it out there and getting it out there as a cult film. And
bringing it to a massive audience as well. Your sway on Radio 1.
I'm not saying everyone loved it, but we helped push it out there. And I remember we certainly did something similar with Napoleon Dynamite, pushing this cult film that needed the push. I didn't do that with Lost in Translation, but I have a thing about Sofia Coppola movies. I just love them. So all of those things could have been the third choice.
James King, as well as asking you for three film choices, on Admit One, I do spring a final question, and that is...
Right.
If you had to choose an actor to play you in your life story, who would that be?
Yeah. Well, I always say that if you're going to choose this, you might as well choose someone amazing.
Go big or go home, James.
Exactly. And choose someone ridiculously good looking. Don't be modest. This is a moment in the spotlight. Mm-hmm. You know, make the most of it. There was a moment in my life where it was after watching The Faculty where I became a little bit obsessed with Josh Hartnett. And he plays a character called Zeke. And he always used to wear like a long sleeve white t-shirt with a short sleeve black t-shirt over the top. And for about a year afterwards, that's all I wore. I just thought it was the coolest outfit I'd ever seen. And he just had that sort of brooding teen idol thing about him. And he's not the greatest actor, but I think he's cool.
Fontaine.
Exactly.
Totally.
Yeah, Trip Fontaine in Virgin Suicides. So I'll forgive him Pearl Harbor and I'll cast him in my life story. Oh. And I'll think, yeah, I'm never going to be as cool as you. But, you know, sod it. This is wishful thinking.
James King, film critic extraordinaire. Thank you so much for coming to Admit One. It has been an absolute pleasure. We didn't drop any F-bombs. And it's been
great. Do you
want
to change that now, just at the end? Or
should we just suddenly lace it with loads of really blue language? Thank you so, so much for your
time
today.
Pleasure, good to see you.
That's it for this episode. Next week on Admit One, TV and radio presenter Sarah Cox.
The whole prostitute thing, basically. How do you put it? I mean, it's kind of a fairy tale, but with a prostitute in it.
Don't forget to subscribe to Admit One on iTunes for more movie memories from my stellar lineup of guests. Admit One with Antonia O'Brien is an Audioboom production.